a coach house, barracks, and a kitchen built separate from the main structure, all constructed from a smooth rock with no visible mortar. The estate itself was a rambling country home built of the same precisely cut stone, something the elite of Colnora might have referred to as a grand villa. The house was three stories high, with gables and a centered portico, complete with stone pillars. Royce counted 5 chimneys and 29 glass windows facing front, including a round one set at the portico's peak. At the very top, the ducal flag flew just below the colours of Auburn. The entry path formed a circle before the front doors, and fine gravel lined a neatly edged lawn, well-trimmed hedges, and early purple flowers that Royce couldn't identify. The style was relaxed, opulent and open, nothing like the homes of Western nobles, which skewed toward the dull and solid, with an emphasis on solid. In places like Warwick and Melengar, a duke's residence was barely discernible from a stronghold. Even successful knights lived in grey stone citadels with narrow, glassless openings. But this place... If the wall was a relatively recent addition, Royce struggled to imagine how the Dukes of Rochelle could have lived in an open, defenseless house. The idea was both incredible and unfathomable. The lack of walls suggests an absence of enemies. But no ruler fits that description. Had the ancient governors been so ruthless that sheer terror replaced the need for walls? Perhaps in place of stone battlements they had encircled the island with posts laden with corpses. Or, an odd, alien thought popped into Royce's head, one that was as unlikely as his walking alongside the captain of the guard into a ducal estate. Could there have been no need for walls, because it was a more virtuous world? The sort of place where Hadrian would have fit in? Royce pondered all this as he walked past the yellow-flowering forsythia bushes, listening to his feet crush the gravel. Hadrian is one of those people born too late. And I... am I born too early? Royce wasn't surprised that obtaining an audience in the dead of night was difficult, even for the captain of the Duke's guard. Wyberg had to browbeat the soldiers at the gate, who complained about his lack of an appointment. At the front doors, Roland had to remind the pair of men about his rank in order to gain entry to the foyer. Looking up, Royce spotted an open third-story window. He could have already entered the Duke's bedroom by then, though the meeting might not have been as cordial with that approach. Inside, the estate continued to impress. The Duke's foyer was ballroom-sized, and decorated with sculptures and paintings instead of swords and shields, the normal ornaments for any serious lord intent on projecting a sense of power. Royce was genuinely impressed by some of the art. When he'd visited such places in the past, the homes were always dark, and he was in too much of a hurry to notice the furnishings. The place was elegant, but he wouldn't want to live there. The residences of the rich always felt cold.
Duke Leopold does not meet with his soldiers in the middle of the night, said the Duke's chamberlain, a portly, balding man who displayed a well-worn frown beneath a neat mustache. While unarmed and unimposing, he was proving to be a worthier adversary than the gate or door guards. With thumbs hooked on the breast of his robe, chest thrust out, he stood blocking the way.
We have a hierarchy to handle problems.
Exactly, and I'm captain of the guard, Wyberg declared.
But did his grace request an audience?
No, this is an emergency.
The chamberlain's frown deepened.
Aren't you supposed to handle emergencies? Why does the Duke have you in charge, if not to provide him the luxury of sleeping at night?
As you can see, the sun is down.
We don't bother him with trifles when he is sleeping.
Trifles? Roland burst out. I just said,
tut, tut.
The Chamberlain placed the palms of his hands together, then tilted the tips of his pressed fingers toward Roland.
This is what you will do. Tomorrow morning, and not too early, you can come and make an appointment to speak to the ducal clerk. Given the feast, I'm sure he'll be too busy to receive you, but if it truly is an emergency...
He looked at Wyberg skeptically.
He'll get you in to see the Duke's secretary. He will evaluate your request and determine if it warrants an audience. If it does, your request will be passed on to the Ducal Council of Attendance, which will review his lordship's itinerary and try and find time in the schedule for you. Now, doesn't that sound like a better way to go about this? I'm sure whatever the problem is, you can manage it for a while.
This can't wait! Roland exploded.
Royce stayed out of the confrontation. He had entered behind the captain, acting as Roland's shadow, and soundlessly moved about the foyer, feigning interest in the art. With all of Wyberg's outbursts, the Chamberlain only gave Royce a cursory glance, then ignored him altogether. Royce inched behind the Chamberlain, slipping beyond his peripheral vision. Spotting a painting of a stag in a river valley, Royce moved toward it. While it wasn't the best art in the room, it was near the corridor. Moving over, he leaned in to inspect it further.
"I must see the Duke tonight!" Wyberg shouted, and thrust his arms out in a rage. "You have no idea what's going on!" "If I don't, calm yourself!"
the Chamberlain snapped, throwing up his hands and cringing as if he felt Wyberg was about to attack. Royce took that opportunity to slip into the unguarded hallway. Wood paneling, tiled floors, and an arched ceiling complete with painted designs in the ducal colors greeted Royce as he trotted down the corridor, moving fast, far faster than if he were burgling. It felt odd. This was wholly without precedent, and Royce wasn't certain how to proceed. What do I do if I spook a servant, or, worse, a guard? He guessed his normal solution might not be the best choice in this instance. He was there to talk to the Duke, not kill him or his servants. He was acting blind. Moving boldly through a lit house, unannounced and unwanted, was strange when doing so with none of the normal tools he used in such situations. This is more like something Hadrian would do. The man is becoming a serious liability. As he searched the vast estate for clues to the Duke's whereabouts, Royce reviewed the pros and cons of continuing his partnership with a man who didn't seem to live in the same world. He genuinely liked Hadrian, although at that moment he wasn't able to bring to mind a single reason why. But is liking something a good enough reason to offset the risks? I like Montemorency wine, but too much will kill me. The more he thought about it, the more similarities he found between them. They both impede my ability to think sensibly, resulting in bad judgments, and too much of either gives me headaches. Still, the best argument was also the worst. Hadrian was wrong. I do have a unicorn in my world, and the damn thing goes by the name of Hadrian Blackwater. He's a mythical beast, impossible to believe in, even when he's right in front of me. Royce had never had the need to believe in anything before, but that was the effect of the unicorn on a mortal man. It made him consider things he thought impossible, because if unicorns were possible, what else might be? In that way, Hadrian was less like Montemorency and more like Alverstone. Perhaps that was why Royce could never throw either of them away. Finding another stair, Royce took it, guessing the Duke slept on the highest floor. Reaching the top, he found the residence to be more inviting. Deeply stained wood and tapestries softened the hard edges. Small tables, topped with bouquet-filled vases, added a dash of personality through spring blossoms. Expansive windows framed with thick green drapes invited moonlight in, and made the house feel more like a home. A three-story one, with a footprint the size of a large island, and filled with priceless art. Royce passed an open door, and spotted a chambermaid turning down a bed. She didn't see him, and Royce slipped quickly past. A boy in a white tunic, who carried a tray of porcelain cups and plates, did see him. But the lad didn't say a word, just walked right past. "I've been doing it all wrong," Royce thought. "Apparently I can saunter into any mansion, lift what I like, and stroll right back out." He looked at the corridor of closed doors and considered his next move. Should I knock? The idea felt absurd. Royce heard a noise behind him and spun to find the chambermaid stepping out, holding a pile of white linens. She, too, saw him. He was certain she had, but the maid, like the boy, didn't raise her eyes to the level of his face. As she turned to leave, Royce had an insane idea. It was the sort of crazy notion that Hadrian would propose. "Excuse me," Royce said, feeling ridiculous. "Where might I find the Duke?" As soon as he said it, Royce knew he'd made a mistake. He wasn't Hadrian, and such things only worked for him. Maybe if I was wearing polka dots.
"I believe his lordship is in the library, sir," the maid replied. "He's having trouble sleeping again, sir."
Royce stared at the woman, dumbfounded. Apparently, mistaking his bewilderment for an unfamiliarity with the estate, she added,
"Around the corner, first door on the left, sir."
Thank you," he replied. She nodded, and walked off with her armload of sheets. "What sort of place is this?"
"Yes, please. Right this way, sir. The Duke is right in here. Have at him, sir. Slit his throat. Would you like tea with that?"
Royce shook his head while watching her vanish down the steps, then remembered why he was there. The door to the library was open, and Royce walked in. What wasn't windows was bookshelves, though there weren't many actual books. Most of the shelves were filled with painted plates, potted plants, intricately carved boxes, models of sailing ships, and even skeletons or stuffed figures of small animals set in poses. A large map hung from the ceiling above the fireplace's hearth, where a meager fire half-heartedly burned. The Duke stood at one of the windows, looking out at the night sky. He was a balding, plump man, the sort that might have been strong and stocky in his youth, but years and wealth had transformed him. He was barefoot, wearing only a long nightshirt that exposed the grey hairs on his calves. "My lord," Royce ventured, trying his best not to sound like a thief. The Duke failed to react, and continued to stare at the window. Royce inched forward, as if sneaking up on a skittish rabbit that might bolt.
"Duke Leopold."
The man turned.
"Oh," he said. "I see." He nodded some understanding that eluded Royce.
Perhaps he thought he was there to retrieve dishes or turn down the bed. The Duke lifted a decanter filled with an amber liquid and poured some into a crystal glass. He held up the decanter in offering. Royce shook his head.
"Do you mind if I..."
He didn't wait for approval and drank, then took a deep breath.
"I'm ready."
"For what?" Royce asked.
"You're here to kill me, right?"
Royce was stunned.
"You look surprised."
What else could you possibly be doing in my residence unannounced this late at night, just before the crowning?
And your cloak and hood, well, it just screams killer.
At least someone is awake in here. That's what separates the Duke from the chambermaids. Paranoia.
"Not going to get any complaints out of me," Leo said. "Honestly, you're doing me a favor."
I'm not here to kill you.
The Duke looked over with an expression that could only be described as annoyed.
No? No. That's disappointing.
He turned.
So, who the blazes are you then? And why are you here?
Footfalls rushed up the steps. Royce pulled the parchment from his belt and held it out. A moment later, soldiers burst into the library. They would have to wait.
To give you this.
The Duke stared at the parchment, puzzled.
What is it?
A letter, Royce said, as a guard stepped toward him. From your wife.
He waited in what they called the parlor, but Royce saw it as just another overly polished medium-sized room with too much art and too few chairs. He was left to himself. No guards watched. The door was open, and he hadn't been shackled or tied. No one had even tried. This was a good thing for everyone involved.
After reading the letter, the Duke had ordered his thugs to let Royce go. Then Leo Hargrave had merely asked him to wait. Royce appreciated that it hadn't been an order. He'd actually used the word, please. Nevertheless, waiting wasn't something Royce was fond of, especially as the night was short, and there was so much left to do if Hadrian was to be extricated from the pickle barrel he'd jumped into. Roland had been ordered to wait as well, but then he was called up for questioning, leaving Royce alone. That had been some time ago. The estate had many paintings. In that room alone, there were 8. Only one caught his eye, the portrait of a man who was unmistakably Leopold. The work was exquisite, and Royce felt uneasy, as if the painting were an actual person in the room with him. The sensation was so pronounced that he went over to inspect it. His eye caught the artist's signature. Sherwood Stowe. Should have known. Royce had no idea what Wyberg was telling the Duke, and that made him uneasy. Just being in an expensively appointed room filled with carvings of elephants and deer, not to mention a silver tea set, made him jumpy. He didn't stay in places of this sort, but he did often visit, and he couldn't help noticing how easily the carvings would fit under his cloak, or avoid calculating what a small fortune they would bring on the black market. The room was chilly, despite the fireplace, because no one had bothered to light it. This left Royce sitting on the velvet and wood chair, feeling the cold seep in, and wondering why he was still there. He thought I was here to kill him. If this job had turned out the way I had expected, I would have been. Royce pictured 2 different paths, running side by side. So close, yet so different. He'd come to Rochelle to kill Leopold. That's what Gabriel Winter had wanted.
Make that goddamn Duke and all those working for him bleed. Turn the Roche River red for me. For me and my Jenny.
Royce had arrived on that road, but somehow he'd gotten off it. Now he was on another path, but the Duke had assumed he was still on the first. Royce felt as if he'd performed sleight of hand, so subtly that the world itself had been duped.
I was duped too.
Even as he sat in that cold, empty room, he could see himself on the other path. I would have stood behind the Duke as he stared at the stars and slit his throat, careful to catch his glass so it didn't shatter. That reality feels more authentic than this one.
That's what I should have done. That's what I was supposed to do.
Royce found it surreal that he should be standing beside that path, looking down and seeing a history that didn't happen. His trajectory had altered course, just a smidge, a tiny tilt. But it was enough to change events from bloodbath to letter delivery.
Were you expecting a finger?
Royce had been expecting a whole lot of fingers, and even more heads. Instead, he sat in a luxurious room, waiting on the ruler of the city to...
He had no idea.
That was the problem with this new path. Royce didn't know where it went.
He'd never gone this way before.
Just as he was deciding that waiting on a duke was about as smart as listening to Hadrian, the duke showed up. The man was dressed, but not in the finery Royce would have expected for a ruling noble. Wearing a crisp shirt, waistcoat, and casual trousers, he looked more like a modest merchant. He was followed by a half-dozen men who were better dressed but appeared worse for wear. Whereas they looked as if they had just woken up, Leo Hargrave beamed as if born again. Bright and smiling, he strode up to Royce and nodded.
"So, old man Winter hired you," Leopold said, and studied Royce's face for his reaction. Royce didn't give one. "He hates me, you know. You're in the Black Diamond, right?"
Royce remained silent, his sight shifting briefly as Roland entered. For better or worse, Wyberg was his advocate, his lifeline out of this, and it was reassuring to see he was still there. This way, when the bastard betrayed him, Royce wouldn't need to hunt him down to slit his throat.
"Doesn't matter," the Duke said, and then chuckled. "And you can relax. Right now, you're my best friend, and I owe you."
Leo shivered. "Why is it so cold in here? Did they leave you so ill-attended?" "Idiots." The man scowled, then lifted the parchment in his hand, grasping it as gently as if it were a newborn.
"My Jenny is alive."
"She won't be if you don't..."
"I know," Leo said. "It was all in the letter. Grant the dwarves the right to work. Give the Calaeans the right to trade. Bestow on the Mere the right to exist. Not something I can simply change overnight. Guilds are powerful things. But Jenny..."
He shook the letter again.
"Never a dull moment with her around, and never a moment's peace. The woman was already working toward those ends. She was fixing the problem that is Rochelle.
She's a businesswoman, you see. Rochelle is a horrible tangle. This city is choked with regulations and procedures, layers upon layers of protocol, and ages steeped in narrow-minded intolerance. She doesn't know anything about such things, had no idea of the impossibility of the task.
That's the way with her, you know. Don't ever tell that woman she can't do something. She'll take it as a challenge.
In this case, she came up with a plan where the existing members of the merchant and trade guilds will receive a percentage of the money earned by the Calaeans and dwarves. She also indicated that if they refused, I should raise taxes on trade goods. Nothing speaks to businessmen like money, or someone threatening theirs. And as it turns out, the daughter of a Colnora merchant baron is fluent in such matters. She was getting close to an agreement, but then she disappeared.
I need to get back, Roy said. I need to bring proof you're planning to do something.
Yes, I know. Jenny mentioned an uprising. Lovely handwriting.
He grinned. She has these pudgy little hands, but her penmanship is beautiful.
Years of keeping books, she told me.
What proof can we provide? Royce pressed.
The Duke gestured at his companions.
These gentlemen are leaders of the city's merchant and trade guilds, the ones Jenny met with. They are quite eager to assist, especially after I explained that if my wife dies, I'll charge them as complicit in the murder, and execute every last one of them.
Leo focused on the sleepy men, and glared.
The king will condemn the murder of prominent merchants, one of the men said.
What king?
The man looked uncomfortable.
Don't worry, Leo smiled. I will definitely hold a trial immediately following your deaths in order to get to the bottom of this conspiracy. And while we are doing that, you can voice your concern to His Late Majesty King Reinhold,
when you see him. I like this guy, Royce thought. Guess we'd better get going. Captain Wyberg will go with you. Good luck. Royce, is it? He sighed and nodded. Royce, the Duke said to himself, as a curious, thoughtful look came over him. I've heard that name before. Let's go, Royce told Roland, and quickly headed for the door. He didn't want to discover what revelations the Duke had uncovered. Chapter 22 The Morning After. With nothing else to do, Hadrian had fallen asleep. He woke to the first light of dawn spilling down the wooden steps from the shack above. The three of them were still huddled in the stone cellar. Griswold sat where he'd always been, hunched up with knees high, his long beard pooling on his lap, demonstrating the patience and unruffled composure of a rock. He still had the dagger, out and ready. Seton had curled up beside Hadrian, using him as a pillow, her hair creating a pool of blonde across his lap. He guessed she'd done it for warmth, or perhaps as a precaution against treachery while she slept. No one can steal me away without waking my protector. For Hadrian, who was cold, cramped, and couldn't feel his hands, the beautiful mirror was a wonderful comfort. In the newborn light that gave everything a spotless purity, she was something more than beautiful, more than a woman, in the same way the first snowfall of the year was more than snow. Both were transcendent. She's so light, like having a cat sleep on me. Hadrian had always felt that cats were picky, untrusting things. Being fragile, they had to be. Whenever a cat sat on him, Hadrian felt special, as if the animal approved, and their acceptance was some sort of gift. Makes a body feel worthy of something to have a cat trust you that much. Hadrian didn't feel worthy. I did one good thing. How quickly does a pure drop of rain disappear in a muddy lake? How many did I kill that night? I don't even remember. In her story, he was a monster who came to slaughter and maim. Hadrian had few illusions about those days, and his memories only got worse the farther he travelled east, where civilization was little more than an inconvenient philosophy. Still, he'd never really seen himself as evil. But I was. Maybe I still am. He looked down. Her eyes were closed, her body rising and falling gently, silently. Maybe she was 100 years old, and had witnessed and even participated in atrocities of her own. Maybe she had closets full of horrible regrets. Who didn't? But in that forgiving light, she was as innocent as a newly budded flower, and she was his savior. Cats don't sleep on monsters, do they? Noises turned Griswold's head and woke Seton. They all listened. Voices coming from outside. The sound soaked through the walls of the overhead shack and dripped down through the gaps in the floorboards. Conversations impossible to clearly hear. Identities were equally vague. Men and women were all Hadrian could reliably discern. Not many, two or three perhaps, but they were coming closer. The dwarf climbed to his feet.
Either your friend's back or time's up. If he's betrayed us...
He pointed the dagger at Hadrian, an old, dull blade.
Is it the same one he uses to carve figurines?
After seeing him with his family, after looking at the beauty he created out of wood, Hadrian found it hard to believe Griswold could kill. But Hadrian had been wrong before. Maybe in a society of stoneworkers, wood carving is an indication of insanity. Griswold might be the sort of crazed killer that no one suspects. Hadrian had met a few of those. Young soldiers, usually the quiet ones that he worried might not be up to the task, revealed a different side on the battlefield. Normally constrained by social pressure, they felt a sense of freedom in combat that they never encountered in daily life. Killing, the ultimate taboo, became a necessary relief to the building pressure to conform. After the fight, they went back to their shadow life. But the taste of blood worked like an infection. They were the ones who volunteered for missions, but fell into trouble after the war. Killers hiding in plain sight. Pots boiling with sealed lids. Griswold might be like that. Hadrian felt Seaton stiffen, as if she'd had the same thought. And then the mirror got to her feet as well, her eyes on the dagger.
That was the deal he made, Griswold told her.
The noise grew louder. Then footfalls hit the floor of the shack, thumping on the ceiling above.
Hadrian! Royce yelled.
Griswold shuffled away from the stairs and toward Hadrian.
No!
Seaton moved with surprising speed, thrusting herself between them and raising her hands, putting up the defense Hadrian couldn't. Griswold's expression was grim, not gleeful, and Hadrian was pleased to see it. At least he doesn't want to kill me, or maybe it's just her he regrets killing.
Stop!
The order came from the stairs where Seely Nim descended.
Griswold Deinge, you put that dagger away. Right now, you hear?
Why? What's happened? Where are Mercator and Villar?
Mercator Sicara is dead,
the Calaean woman said. This did nothing to improve the dwarf's attitude, and his expression went from grim to angry.
Was it the small one who did it?
Royce joined her at the bottom of the stairs, and Griswold took a tighter grip on the dagger. Hadrian got to his feet. The dwarf let out a heated growl.
What happened to Mercator? I don't see...
That's right, Griswold. You don't see anything.
The widow was furious.
Mercator Sicara was murdered, and it's all your fault.
My fault? Don't be ridiculous. I've been here with them all night.
Mercator was torn apart by a golem.
She could have hit the dwarf with a bucket of water and gotten the same response. He stopped not only his movement toward Hadrian, but even his breathing. A fortunate turn for Griswold, as by then Royce was past the widow, and Alverstone was out and ready to say hello.
Drop the dagger, or lose the hand,
Royce ordered, in the sort of voice that allowed no hesitation or argument. Griswold let his blade fall and backed away, but his eyes were still trained on Erasmus's widow, still aghast.
Damn it,
Royce cursed, kicking the blade away and frowning at the dwarf.
They never pick the choice I want.
The dwarf had backed up all the way to the wall, retreating from more than Royce.
I don't understand. How could a golem kill Mercator?
You tell me, you little bearded excuse for a mole rat!
The widow was filled with fury.
Erasmus had always been against using those things, those evil, disgusting creatures. And now? Now?
She took a deep breath to compose herself.
Who have you taught that evil sorcery? Do you see what price has been paid? Mercator is dead, and so is my Erasmus.
He killed your husband,
Griswold pointed at Hadrian. He didn't. Seaton looked at Seely in desperation. The widow patted Seaton's cheek.
Honey, do you think I would believe anything coming out of his mouth?
Erasmus's face was damn near chewed away.
What happened to my?
That wasn't done by any man.
I...
Seaton began. The widow was done with her, but not with Griswold.
You're the only one who knows. The only one who...
The widow put her hands to her hips, her eyes narrowing to the sort of slits archers use when targeting small prey.
hundreds of people saw a golem in the plaza last night. That stony monster climbed down the side of the cathedral, smashed into the gallery, and tore that poor woman apart. First my Erasmus, now Mercator. All because it wasn't me. I was here with them.
He gestured toward Hadrian and Seton.
But you showed others. You're the only one who knows how. Who else did you teach that vile black magic to? Who else can raise a golem?
Griswold bowed his head.
Just three of us. Only three. I had to, you see, as a kind of safeguard. A way to ensure no single person, no one sect had more power than the others. And so each race would have equal power. I was one, your husband another.
She glared. Who was the last?
Vialar, Royce said, cutting Hadrian's bonds free. The dwarf's eyes indicated agreement.
Mercator figured it out, Royce said. He never left any note with demands. He used Leopold's lack of action to fuel dissent and his bloody little war. He was trying to stop us from getting to the Duke. Mercator tried to talk him out of it, but it didn't go so well.
Did you get into the estate? Were you able to see the Duke? Hadrian asked.
Royce nodded. And here's Wyberg and a group of guild leaders in the meeting hall right now. They're discussing the Duke's intentions and what changes will be coming. Looks like Mercator accomplished that much at least. There won't be any revolution.
He looked at Hadrian.
I told Roland we'd take care of getting the Duchess back to the estate.
Hadrian's fingers suffered the dreaded pins and needles as blood flowed back to them. To his surprise, Seton, whose face was streaked with tears, took his hands and rubbed them. With his hands returning to normal, Hadrian clapped and rubbed them together.
Let me get my swords, and we'll get going.
So, where is she?
He asked Royce.
Don't know.
He looked to Griswold. The dwarf began shaking his head, though Hadrian doubted the dwarf was aware of it. He had a lost, horrified look, as if he'd just woken up with blood on his hands.
I don't know. No one does.
What do you mean, no one?
Hadrian asked.
The Duchess was the Mir's responsibility, and only Vilar and Mercator know where they took her.
But the Duchess isn't the real problem.
Then what is? Hadrian asked.
If Vilar doesn't want reforms, and is only after bloodshed and violence, then nothing. He has no mob to follow his...
He doesn't need anyone's help.
You don't understand,
Griswold interrupted, his face white.
He knows how to create a golem. You have no idea how much damage they can do.
Think I have a pretty good idea, Roy said. Had one chasing me most of the night.
Trust me, it can be much worse.
But why? Hadrian asked. Why would Vilar be so bent on violence?
Royce shrugged. Frustration, revenge, hate. He blames others for his lot in life. His father never appreciated him.
The weather has been cloudy. Take your pick.
People have an inexhaustible supply of excuses to wreak havoc. In this case, however, Vilar has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity,
Griswold said.
He can raise an unstoppable monster. And later today, all the nobles of Ulbern, the very people Vilar blames for his misfortunes, are going to be gathered in one place. It'd take no time for him to tear through that crowd.
Hadrian shook his head.
Vilar's last golem had to have made an impression. It'll keep everyone away. People are probably fleeing the city as we speak.
We're talking about nobles vying for the crown, Roy said. No one is going anywhere.
Silly Nim nodded.
It's Vilar that we have to find.
She turned to the dwarf.
Maybe you don't know exactly where he is, But you know something. Some way to narrow the search.
Griswold nodded. To raise a golem, you have to be on consecrated ground.
What does that mean? Royce asked.
It has to have been blessed, sacred. Otherwise, you're committing suicide.
How so?
Raising a golem requires trapping a demon and forcing it inside a statue.
They don't like that, and the first person they'll kill is their creator.
Golems can't step on consecrated ground, so that's the only safe place to raise one. If they can't reach the summoner, they're forced to act as his puppet.
Does that have something to do with the boxes you were handing out? Do they have to spread it around or something? Hadrian asked.
No, the boxes are filled with the residue, the waste bits and chips that were chiselled off the statues when they were created. Using them, the summoner can animate the statue related to its corresponding bits. The plan had been for Erasmus, myself, and Villar to raise golems to aid in the uprising. I was going to use the church near the graveyard, the place where you saw me give Erasmus his box of gravel.
So, where else can this be done? Hadrian asked. Will any graveyard work? Any church?
That's the thing. There aren't many places in Rochelle that meet the requirements. It's not like anyone can throw salt around and say some magic words.
The site must be on a focal point. Griswold looked at them, then sighed again.
It's hard to explain if you aren't a dwarf. Even hard for some of us to understand. So many of the old ways have been lost since we were scattered to the winds by the Empire.
He cupped his hands.
It's like this. There are places, natural places, in the world, that are centres of power. You've heard of Avanpartha, right? That's an example. Drumador is another. Power rises to the surface in places like that, and people have built structures on them to harness that strength, sometimes without even knowing why.
Grumgallimus, Royce said. Griswold nodded.
That's where Erasmus...
He looked at the widow and cringed.
Was going to raise his golem.
Villar was going to be somewhere else.
Where? I don't know. You wouldn't tell anyone.
How long can a summoner control his golem? Royce asked.
It comes down to a force of wills. The summoner needs to conduct the actions of the golem. You see through its eyes and direct its movements. But it hates being used, so the whole time you have to concentrate and be mindful about the amount of time the connection is in place. Keeping control for too long is dangerous.
How so?
Hang on too long, and you lose your soul and become permanently trapped inside the golem. It becomes immortal and nearly indestructible.
Yeah, okay, Roy said. That's worse. How long does that take?
Generally, we try not to hold the connection for more than a few hours, but a golem can do a lot of damage in that amount of time. Best way to stop the summoner is to force him to sever the connection.
And how do you do that? Royce asked.
Distract, threaten, or kill him.
So the connection is broken if the summoner dies?
Yes. Sounds like a plan to me.
A smile grew on Royce's lips.
I think I would prefer stopping him before he makes another one, Hadrian said, moving to the steps.
What are you going to do?
Griswold asked. Hadrian shrugged.
We have a tendency to make this stuff up as we go.
Amir had been waiting at the top of the stairs and handed Hadrian his weapons without saying a word. After Hadrian strapped them on, he jogged to catch up to Royce.
What's the plan? He asked, as they walked down a roadway. He knew it was called Centre Street, only because the name was neatly stencilled on a wooden road sign that the birds loved more than the residents did, as evidenced by the white streaks on the placard and pole. The street, as far as Hadrian could tell, tracked due west toward the plaza.
He knew this not due to any growing understanding of the city, but because he could see the spires of Grom Gallimus straight ahead. The tallest building by far in the city, the cathedral could always be seen rising above the other roofs. Not sure, I'm thinking. The two were as alone as they could be that morning, in a cramped city that was coming alive with the rising sun. Griswold, Seaton, and Seely Nim had remained to aid Roland with quelling the rebellion.
"Happy first day of spring,"
Hadrian offered, along with a yawn, as they walked by a shop where the owner flipped over a sign, presumably for the first time that year. It had read, "Dried herbs," but now announced, "Fresh flowers." Royce gave him a sidelong glance. "Don't do that again."
"You have something against spring? When did that happen?"
"Don't offer yourself as a hostage."
"Oh, that..."
Hadrian yawned again. He hadn't gotten much sleep, and it was starting to drag on him.
"Don't owe that me,"
Royce reprimanded, sounding eerily like Evelyn Hemsworth.
"This is not a laughing matter. You put me in a box."
"I put you in a box? See, I saw it as me putting myself in one."
"You did both. In our line of business, associations are liabilities. Loyalties are points of weakness. They get you killed. If they had captured you, locked you up, that would have been fine. But you... how would that have been fine?"
"I would have just killed them." Royce said this in such a matter-of-fact tone that Hadrian failed to question the boast. If it had been anyone else, Hadrian would have passed it off as bombastic bluster. But Royce wasn't bragging, wasn't exaggerating to make a point. He was serious, and to him this was a practical matter, a basic trade rule, like not shoveling manure into the wind.
"But when you volunteer to act as collateral," Royce went on, "that puts me in a tight spot. The stakes go up, and I can't walk away if things take a nasty turn. Like this one did."
"Is this your way of saying you care about me?" Royce continued his Evelyn Hemsworth impersonation by displaying an "I can't believe you really exist" expression.
"This is my way of saying you're an idiot, and the next time you do something that stupid, I'll let them kill you."
Hadrian smiled.
"You really like me, don't you?"
"Shut up." "I feel bad now," Hadrian said. "I didn't get you anything for spring day." Royce walked faster, shaking his head as he moved forward. The sun was barely up, but already the day displayed all the indications that it would be glorious. The sky was blue, the sunshine bright, the temperature warmer than it had been in days. Birds built nests under the eaves of shops as owners threw wide winter shutters, letting the birdsong in. How rare that the first day of spring lived up to expectations. That sentiment was on every face as people crept out of dark homes to celebrate the holiday of rebirth. Mothers dressed their children in fine clothes, delivering stern ultimatums and handing out rules against doing anything beyond standing still. Young women burst out of doorways resembling budding flowers as they twirled their dresses of bright yellows, pinks, and greens, full of excitement that they might attract the attention of a handsome bee or two. The usual vendors were not present in the plaza. Even they had taken the day off. In their place, musical bands were in the process of setting up, while men who moved awkwardly in waistcoats, capes, and shiny buckled shoes set up banquet tables or roped off squares for dancing. One area suffered from an odd break in the boundary, where several shattered paving stones created a nasty crater. Hadrian noted that even though the steps of the gallery had been cleaned, there was still a rusty tinge on some of them, and one of the beautiful doors had been battered and torn. The tragedy of the previous night had been mostly erased by the morning light and the new season. But just like winter, the hardships couldn't be entirely forgotten. The people in the plaza moved around the crater and avoided the steps to the gallery. Still, they were unwavering in their efforts to celebrate the spring. Surviving was often a matter of moving forward. Moving forward was a matter of putting yesterday in the past, and all of it began with putting one foot ahead of the other, remembering how to smile, how to dance, and especially remembering that laughing wasn't disrespectful. It was essential. Hadrian's attention was pulled away by the grand procession underway as 10 men carried a massive garland-festooned post across the bridge. The spring pole, streaming ribbons of various colors, was headed to the plaza, where it would be erected for the opening dance. Hadrian's home village of Hintendar put up a spring pole every year as well, though not nearly so big. He imagined every town did. Rochelle planned on celebrating on a scale Hadrian couldn't imagine. Feeling the energy and anticipation, he wanted to join in, help put up the pole, roll out the barrels, and find a partner for the rabbit run and the blossom ball. But they still had work to do. As if realizing only then that he was walking, Royce stopped. He took in a long breath and let out a sigh of frustration. "What's wrong?" "I've got nothing. Vilar is the only one left who knows where the Duchess is." Royce looked around at all the congested buildings. "He could be anywhere." "No," Hadrian said. "He has to be somewhere special. Someplace sacred." "Sure, okay. But what is considered special or holy in Rochelle? Do you know?" "Because I don't. This is the problem with taking jobs outside our neighborhood. Even Griswold, who I'm guessing has lived here his whole life, only knew about two places. And if Erasmus was using the cathedral and the dwarf the old church, then where was Vilar going? Griswold would have mentioned other sites if he knew any." "Vilar knows of at least one more, obviously," Hadrian said. "He's a Mir. And Mir live for a long time, right? So it might be something ancient. Something everyone else has forgotten about. How does that help?"
"Maybe we just need to find someone who knows a lot about the ancient history of Rochelle."
Hadrian smiled.
"Can you think of anyone like that, Royce?"
Royce's eyes widened.
"Oh, you are kidding me!"
Chapter 23. A Prayer to Novron. Like the rest of the city, Mill Street had been transformed. The quiet thoroughfare of dignified homes was festooned with whimsical decorations. Nearly every house had garlands of spring flowers and pastel-colored ribbons in loops beneath windows.
Some homeowners extended the loops beneath two windows, creating smiling faces with flowered lips and crisscrossed glass eyes.
Here, too, groups of residents gathered in small clumps, chatting on a street devoid of its normal traffic. 5 men in tall hats spoke in the middle of the road. A larger group of women in hoop skirts gathered near the lamppost, which had been trimmed with a spiraling green ribbon. One bent down to pet a little pug-nosed dog.
"Where have you two been?"
Evelyn burst out the moment they entered the house. With arms tightly folded, she stood beside a table of uneaten food.
"Just when I thought you'd been tamed, you prove that wild animals can never truly be domesticated."
She looked at the grand banquet she had prepared, as if she might cry. "But even a wild animal?" She waved at the table.
"It's food, after all. Even a cave-dwelling beast will make a habit of being on time for a feast."
"Our sincere apologies," Hadrian said. "We were unavoidably detained."
"Whose prison?" she asked.
Royce wiped his feet on the doormat and removed his cloak. Hadrian took off his sword belt. They needed her cooperation and couldn't afford to irritate Evelyn any more than she already appeared to be.
"Did the Duke catch you, or was it some underworld thug who locked you up? What makes you..." "Oh, honestly."
She scowled and grabbed her skirt while stepping to the head of the table. Royce moved quickly and pulled out the chair for her. She frowned.
If I look that simple-minded to you, I suggest investing in canes to help you walk like all the others, Novron punished with blindness. The only surprise about you two is that my silverware hasn't gone missing, which, incidentally, is the only reason you are still here. I have friends in the Duke's court. My husband was very popular there, you know. In a way, he, more than the Duke, paid their salaries. I would have seen both of you in chains if so much as a toothpick had been pilfered.
I didn't even see the toothpicks. Royce glanced at Hadrian. Hadrian shook his head.
Evelyn tilted hers and peered sternly at the both of them.
At this point, there is nothing either of you can say to redeem yourselves. I told you no jiggery-pokery, did I not? No shady business. But here we are. I'd throw you out now, but I can't stand wasting food. So, sit down and eat your last meal under my roof. Immediately afterward, please gather your things and leave. I'll have no more to do with either of you.
But, Hadrian started. She shut him down with a raised hand.
No! No. I don't want to hear your excuses. Just eat and get out. The eggs are ruined, and the pastries are likely hard, but that's your fault.
They settled into chairs. Hadrian reached to uncover the food plates, but Royce stopped him.
What are you waiting for?
Evelyn asked, annoyed.
We haven't given thanks.
And before Evelyn could reply, Royce bowed his head.
We thank you, Lord Novron, for the food Mrs. Hemsworth has made for us, and apologize for being late. We weren't in a prison.
Well, Hadrian was. Sort of, but only because he volunteered to risk his life to save the Duchess of Rochelle.
She's still alive, by the way, but being held prisoner by a murderous Mere. The same one who brought the stone gargoyle to life and hurt all those people in the plaza. Oh, and it killed Mercator Sicara, a Mere who was only trying to keep peace between the pitifuls and the nobles. More would have died if I hadn't managed to lure the thing to the top of Drumgallimus and cause it to fall, shattering on the plaza. Despite all this, we would have still been on time, except we haven't yet found the Mere holding the Duchess, and we're in a bit of a hurry because he may kill her at any moment. Oh yeah, and he's intent on unleashing a great deal of bloodshed later today. So, Lord Novron, we've been a tad busy. We hope you understand and forgive us for our tardiness.
Royce looked at Evelyn, who stared at him incredulously.
May we prove worthy of your kindness.
She concluded the prayer with wide eyes that looked back at Royce, dumbfounded. Hadrian gave her a big smile as he uncovered the food and scooped spoonfuls onto his plate, then passed it on to Royce.
Are you... Was that true?
She asked.
I wouldn't lie to Novron,
Royce told her through a mouthful of eggs, which were not at all ruined.
Who are you?
Royce glanced at Hadrian. Normally, this was where his less experienced partner would put them in jeopardy, openly admitting everything because someone had gone to all the trouble of asking. Hadrian, however, kept himself occupied with the meal. Neither of them had dined the night before, and Hadrian was fond of repeating the military axiom, never pass up a chance to eat or sleep, as you don't know when you'll get another opportunity. Royce turned back to Evelyn Hemsworth, who waited with a cringing expression, a look that was half dread, half curiosity. She wanted to know, and at the same time, she didn't. Royce used the moment it took to chew and swallow to mentally sort through the most reasonable replies. None worked for this. After his acrobatics and his admission that they were seeking to save the Duchess, he couldn't exactly pretend they were travelling merchants or agents for such. He toyed with the idea of saying they were undercover Surrett knights, but Royce was certain Evelyn knew more about the Surrett than he did. He also considered refusing to answer at all, but that wouldn't do. They needed her help, and while his message of grace had blunted her anger, She was many leagues from trusting him. With all other options eliminated, and this being an absurd situation,